recounting ballots, an old Florida story, and it's happening again after the midterm election. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, have questions about the recount? Still want to talk about the election? Well, give us a call. We're doing it right now at 549-2937. Then later, marking the war to end all wars 100 years ago. That's happening around town this Veterans Day weekend. We'll tell you about that too, all of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, the election may be over, but this is Florida, which means the recounts are just getting underway. Bill Nelson is challenging the results in his Senate race between him and outgoing Governor Rick Scott after a very close result. There's also a likely recount happening in the Agriculture Commissioner race between Matt Caldwell and Nikki Fried. Now, one aspect of a recount in this state means that county supervisors of elections across Florida have to convene canvassing boards to count challenged or provisional ballots. Remember those canvassing boards from Palm Beach in particular in the year 2000, the Hanging Chad era of Florida recounts? Well, we've improved our election technology quite a bit since 2000. So there's a new process, but it sort of begs the question, if challenged or provisional ballots are counted at high enough numbers, would that change the results or not? And here's another question. After losses now in every major statewide race, where does the Florida Democratic Party go from here? And what's the agenda for Republicans who have made a sweep of the Sunshine State? Joining us in studio, we're pleased to welcome Katie Ross. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And by phone, Stephanie Mickle, both of Mickle Public Affairs. Stephanie, good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And as we talk about the recount, we want your questions and comments. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. And Stephanie, let's begin with you. You're an attorney. You understand election law. As these recounts begin, there's a short window of time that the county supervisors of elections have to go over everything again, and challenged or provisional ballots will be part of that. Can you explain a little bit about that process and whether it's perhaps wishful thinking maybe by Democrats to think that that might change the result? What can we expect out of the recount now?
Well, I think there are a couple of things, and let's talk a little bit about process. So all of the supervisors of elections have until this Saturday at noon to finish counting ballots that have come in. This includes overseas ballots. It includes vote-by-mail ballots that they haven't counted. A lot of people think that all the votes are actually counted on Election Day. And for whatever reason, as a practical matter, that typically does not happen. So each of the supervisors of elections are given additional time to count ballots. That's one of the reasons people are interested in seeing whether or not the 0.5% requirement that's under Florida law, meaning if my race and your race are, or my votes and your votes are less than a margin of 0.5% in a statewide election, that would include the Florida Senate race, the Florida governor's race, the Florida Agricultural Commissioner's race, any other statewide race, it automatically triggers a recount. And that recount would be a machine recount first. And I only bring this up because when we talked about the Hanging Chads back in 2000, a lot of people remember the headache and the crazy nightmare that that was and how long it took for canvassing boards to come in and process some of this stuff. The machines will run, they'll run everything back through the machines first. And so, you know, hopefully that will help to clear up some of the uncertainty around the recount. Now they have, when the recounts are actually triggered, they'll have a week from now until November the 15th to certify and to process those votes. So we'll know within a week, hopefully, that what the machine recount tells us. If for some reason we see that a race is separated by 0.25% or less, so, you know, think of it this way, 0.5 is now, in a week it'll be 0.25, then we'll have a manual recount automatically required by law, which will have to be wrapped up by November 18th, which is 10 days from today.
Okay. And it's 549-2937 to join us. Katie Ross, with the race for governor between Ron DeSantis and Andrew Gillum, that fell just outside that 0.5%. The margin was just a little too large for Gillum to call for a recount. However, in the race between Nelson and Scott, it's within that very narrow margin, something like 30,000 votes or less. You used to work for Senator Nelson. Let's disclose that. But, 30,000 votes is a slim margin. But if challenge ballots and provisional ballots are counted, what do you think about those who are saying, well, maybe this could change the results? That hasn't happened before in recent history, has it?
Not that I know of, Melissa, but I think it's just a matter of waiting and seeing in terms of recounting some of these ballots. Stephanie had mentioned provisional ballots, vote by mail, and the fact that the counting of the ballots goes on way beyond the election day sometimes.
We're getting tweets about this in Jacksonville. The Duval County Supervisor of Elections, for example, will count 300 provisional ballots this morning that the Duval Canvassing Board reviewed last night. There are another 500 to 600 pending that will be reviewed today. So certainly, Stephanie, Democrats are hoping that Nelson can close the gap. How likely is that, though?
Well, certainly they are hoping that Nelson can close the gap. As a practical matter, history has shown us that the challenger does not always make up the difference. And just so just for your listeners, full disclosure, I too used to work for Senator Nelson. So I'm happy to share that with you all. But the other thing I want to just mention, and this is what's fascinating to me as a student of politics, is that I took a look at the State Division of Elections website this morning before coming on the air to join you, Melissa. And in the DeSantis-Gillum race, the difference is now 0.52. So when you talk about Duval County reviewing 300 votes from yesterday, another 500 from today, other counties around the state reviewing these numbers, Democrats are hoping that there's going to be enough in those provisional ballots, in those numbers, to trigger automatic recounts for Senator Nelson, for Andrew Gillum, and for Nikki Fried, who's the Democratic candidate for agricultural commissioner. But they do have an uphill battle for sure.
And going beyond the recount, let me ask you, both of you, Katie, in this environment where across the country, Democrats took Congress back, elected a number of people to governorships, elected a record number of women, Democrats just got wiped out here in Florida. And so, if Nelson is ousted from the Senate, as, it appears to be likely, this recount won't be successful for him, although we'll wait for the final tally. There will not be a single elected statewide Democrat left in Florida. And so what on earth does the Democratic Party have to say for itself? There's been quite a bit of finger pointing and hand wringing and blaming and second guessing about how the party went about getting people to the polls and motivating people in this political environment where Democrats did so well across the country. What do the state's Democrats in Florida, what do they need to be doing differently to try to rebuild what seems to be a decimated structure right now in the wake of these elections?
Well, I first would like to say that I was there was quite a lot of ground game, I think, on both sides, and a lot of good efforts to get out the vote, get folks to the polls. I know texting has been a big trend in terms of reaching out to folks, sending postcards. So I know a lot of folks kind of engaged in a full court press.
Certainly in Duval County, Duval turned a little more blue this time, but at the statewide level, it's just been nothing but failure.
I think that the Democratic Party is doing a better job in terms of forming farm teams, as you might say, kind of grooming candidates, that kind of succession planning in terms of Democratic political leadership here in Florida. And I hope that they continue to do that. I feel like you had a lot of excellent candidates, particularly female candidates this time in Florida, who either won or they put up a hell of a fight. So I think continuing to push on that ground game, continuing to connect with voters, a diverse group of voters, seeing what issues that they care about and continuing to, you know, groom folks to run for these offices who have a real chance of winning.
Stephanie Michael, your thoughts. You run a public affairs firm, and, you know, it really speaks to just the demographics and the way these elections go in Florida, in non-presidential years especially.
You know, Melissa, and I actually think that another area where the Florida Democratic Party can really improve, in addition to the ground game, in addition to grooming candidates, is coordination. And coordination has been a huge challenge for the party, continues to be a huge challenge for the party. But in terms of really making the improvements and looking to see where we can make up some ground, that's, I think, a huge opportunity for the party, the statewide party, to look. So what I mean by coordination is, you know, making sure that everybody who's on the ticket feels like they're being incorporated into the overall messaging, the overall strategy, the overall campaign effort. And so I think that's super, super important if the party is going to try to make the progress that they want to be able to make in future elections. And you're absolutely right. Off years are a lot harder to get people out to vote. People have to see that their interests are represented. And when you talk about demographics, that's a huge issue. Our state is becoming more and more diverse. We have people moving into the state at record numbers. It's one of the fastest growing states in the country. I think it's number 3 or number 2. And because of those things, you know, we always have to be making sure that potential voters see their interests represented. If I don't see my interests represented, and I have to decide between whether or not I'm going to go vote or whether or not I'm going to do something else, and I don't feel a connection to the candidates, I don't feel a connection to my issues, I may not make that choice.
Let's go to some calls now. It's 549-2937. John is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, what happens if the Secretary of State refuses to order the recount?
Go ahead, Stephanie. Thanks, John.
So under Florida law, thank you so much for the call, but under Florida law, if the difference is between 0.5% or less, they have to, it shall. It's a requirement of the Secretary of State. So it's not like we saw in 2000 where it was subjective. The Florida legislature has passed laws since then to try to address a number of the problems that we saw in 2000.
Right. And it's Secretary of State Ken Detzner who would oversee this. 549-2937, Chuck at the Beaches. Hey, Chuck, how are you?
Hey, guys, I'm doing well. It's quite remarkable as to how close the election was for the governor and the senator. And I just wanted to make one comment about the race for the governorship. I think Mr. Gillum could have won if he had just changed his vocabulary and his approach a little bit. He didn't have to get many more votes to win. And if you go back and look at what he said about police officers and how they should not handle their firearms, he didn't have to say that. If you go back and look at his approach to the Second Amendment, he could have adjusted that a little bit and been more pro-friendly to the Second Amendment. And the things he said about the president impeaching him and things. Vocabulary and language is extremely important. I think he could have won if he had just adjusted his approach a little different. And that's true with every person who's running, whether it's how you feel about the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh, et cetera. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for that. Katie Ross, what about his comment?
I will say that Andrew Gillum ran certainly a very energizing campaign. I think his vocabulary had a lot of intent behind it in terms of appealing to voters, particularly younger people. You know, when you talk about the Second Amendment and gun control and that kind of issue, it people have very firm opinions about it. And I think Andrew Gillum leaned into his opinion.
He really departed from previous Democrats for campaigning for statewide office and firing up a progressive base, not going a middle path. And it proved to fall just short. So will the Democratic Party reevaluate that approach now in the wake of this loss and think about going back to a more centrist approach or candidate next time? Or not?
Well, I'll tell you, I can't necessarily speak for the Florida Democratic Party, but I will say that I believe Andrew Gillum and some of the issues in his platform are certainly the future of the Democratic Party. I feel like Democrats are looking for folks like Andrew Gillum, particularly younger folks. And as the state begins to grow and become more diverse, I think we'll continue to see this shift to the left in the Democratic Party.
Stephanie.
Yes. I agree with Katie, and I think what we saw from the Gillum campaign is tracking what we're seeing across the nation. The National Democratic Party really, really struggled after the 2016 election to reinvent itself, to find its center, and what we saw as a result of that was a number of progressive candidates, a number of non-traditional Democratic candidates really come forward. I'm thinking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others, Beto O'Rourke and others, who people are really believe are going to be the future of the Democratic Party. And so, you know, I think that the statewide party will probably at some point start to track that as well.
Let's go to Lee on the north side. Hi, Lee. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. How are you guys doing?
Great, thanks.
Good. My question was, I wanted to know whether or not your panelists thought that race had any impact on the gubernatorial election. And the reason I'm asking that is because when you look at the numbers that Mayor Gillum got with regards to, and compare them to the numbers that Senator Nelson got, there were about 43,000 votes that were left on the table. And I'm just trying to figure out how, what would be the cause for you to vote for Nelson but not Gillum.
Okay. Let's talk about that. Stephanie, you know,
Sure.
the election, Bill Nelson got more votes than Andrew Gillum. And it's impossible to know whether race was a factor in that, whether Gillum was a victim of the so-called Bradley effect. That was a candidate that ran for office years ago that was leading in all of the polls, I think, in California, and then lost, and it was felt at the time that it was due to people willing to tell a pollster they were going to vote for him, but didn't want to vote for him when they got into the voting booth. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, race certainly was a factor, but let me tell you what I mean by that, because I don't per se believe it was the Bradley effect. I think it was things that came out during the campaign, which was, you know, comments that were made that were offensive to many. I also think, to an earlier caller's point, that, you know, there were some people who were less comfortable with his position on gun control. So I do think that in those regards that race was a factor. The other thing I think also is that Senator Nelson is a very moderate Democrat, always has been. And I think for many people, they felt more comfortable with knowing what they were going to get because he has a pretty lengthy record on public service. So I think, you know, those would be my two observations about what happened and from a race perspective.
Patricia in Mandarin. Hi, Patricia. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Actually, I'm looking online and because I mailed in my vote and it's still showing as received and not tabulated.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard that from some folks, and I'm not sure. I don't have an answer for you because I'm not an elections expert. But what Katie and Stephanie, the mail voting by mail, you can check to see if your vote has been tabulated, and so don't they have a little time to get everything done to make sure that every vote is tabulated?
Yes, they have a little time to do that, and you're absolutely, it's a great call to double check and see where they are in terms of having counted your vote. However, and I would just say this with all, you know, caution, is if this is still the case at noon today, I would call over there, I would show up, or I would fax them a letter saying what's the status of my vote being counted.
And what about these challenged ballots? Provisional and challenged ballots will be reviewed over the next several days. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, that's correct. They will. But You know, I like to explain it this way. They will be counted over the next several days, but to be early is to be on time. It is my view on voting. And so that's part of the reason I encourage the previous caller to just go ahead and check. Because, yes, they do have time to do this, but the longer you wait to make sure that these things are confirmed, the less likely you as a voter are to have some assurances that your vote actually counts.
Rod in St. Augustine. Hi, Rod. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Melissa. I was just calling. Now that Andrew Gillum didn't win, does he automatically go back to Tallahassee to be the mayor of Tallahassee? Thank you, and that's my question.
Yeah, Katie, I mean, if people are wondering about the losing candidate's future, certainly Democrats hope he'll come back. But yeah, going back to being the mayor.
You know, I'm not familiar with the election cycle or the election rules in the city of Tallahassee and Leon County, but I can tell you that I feel Andrew Gillum isn't going anywhere, and he's going to continue to raise his profile, not just in Florida, but on a national level. I think his energy and his warmth and his knowledge of the issues are hard to deny. So no matter what happens to Mayor Gillum, whether he goes back to being the mayor of Tallahassee or runs again, I think he's going to be a fixture on the national political scene.
We will see Gillum emerge nationally, Stephanie, and also some other candidates around the country that lost this week, like Beto O'Rourke, who lost narrowly in Texas to Senator Ted Cruz. And so we will see that in 2020, I'm sure they'll be in the conversation. But, you know, 2 years is a long way off, and for the short term here in Florida, we will have Republican Ron DeSantis as governor. We have two Republican senators now, and we have a fully Republican cabinet. And so Florida will continue with the policy prescriptions that it's long held: low taxes, a lightly regulated state. And so this will be the reality in Florida for the next several years. This is something that is interesting to look at, given that the state is so purple. And, you know, you've got so many people moving to Florida from really, frankly, high tax northern states, and they vote with their feet. They come to Florida because they want a lower tax environment primarily, and maybe also for the good weather. But on a host of other issues, voters aren't as conservative. So what are your thoughts about how the state is being led now, given these complexities that you look at in the electorate?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things that I would point to. One is that even though we don't have another major election for 2 years, there are going to be a number of local elections that will be taking place over the next couple of years. And so to Katie's note earlier about the pipeline for Democratic candidates, that will create some opportunities as well for more diverse perspectives. That said, I don't think that it's never a good idea to say just because my party is not in office, that means that I don't have a right to contact them and make sure that my voice and my issues are still heard. Now, because politicians are animals such that they do respond to public pressure. And so I would just encourage people who may be feeling like, wow, you know, I'm not going to have any representation at all in any way. I don't necessarily think that will hold if there is adequate pressure brought to bear.
Greg on the north side. Hi, Greg. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning. Let me give you, Melissa, thank you for taking my call. Give you my demographics. I'm a 54-year-old African-American male, Democrat, Southern Baptist, that's a police officer. I did vote for Andrew Gillum, but some of my friends and I have discussed some things, and like your previous caller said, the issues on dealing with police and the Second Amendment were very concerning to me and my friends. And I tell you, if the Democratic Party continues to move in a very liberal direction, I may have to become independent, because being that, and there are a lot of us in the different demographic that I have stated, a lot of people don't understand a lot of black people are conservative at their nature. And if the Democratic Party continues to move in that direction, they're going to lose a lot of people, probably to the independents, but we're not going to become Republican.
Greg,
just like a lot of Republicans that when the Republican Party is moving too far right are leaving the Republican Party.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of independents in Florida that have done what you just described, Greg. About a third of the voters. Thanks for that call, Greg. Okay, Katie Ross, what about that? Now you both talked about how the future of the Democratic Party. You're going to lose some voters, like Greg, most likely. What about that?
Well, you know, the Democratic Party has always been very diverse. We're definitely a heterogeneous group of folks. And, you know, you hear the term, we're a big tent party. We want to be as inclusive as possible. You know, again, gun control is becoming more and more of an issue. We had a shooting, unfortunately, last night in California.
Mass shooting, 12 people dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that it's going to continue to stay at the forefront. You know, you talk about assault weapons, assault weapon ban, bump stocks, kind of focusing on those issues. And hopefully I'd like to see those go forward. And I wanted to just kind of ring into a previous caller's question and reiterate what Stephanie said in terms of not being discouraged, in terms of feeling as though you can't reach out to your elected officials. You absolutely can. I've seen it. She and I have seen it firsthand professionally, how elected officials, you know, really take that into consideration. So I think one of the great things that came out of this election in Florida for Democrats is really a resurgence of activism. Different groups, even from outside the political framework and the party, groups like Indivisible, groups like the Women's March, those folks are already pretty organized. So just kind of tapping into that network going forward after the election is very important.
Elizabeth on the South Side. Hi, Elizabeth. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I just wanted to speak a second to a previous question about how did race play into the votes for Gillum versus Nelson? And my husband had the experience of, we're lifelong Democrats, working a phone bank for the party prior to the election, where we were only calling registered Democrats. And one of the calls that he made was to an older white woman and just encouraging her to get out and vote. And she had said that she had already mailed in her ballot. He thanked her for her vote for Gillum. And her response was, oh, no, I had to vote for the other guy. And my husband didn't quite understand what she meant or why. And she just continued and said, they're getting too powerful. And my husband questioned her. He said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And she said, you know, since Obama, they're getting too powerful. And the implication was race. And he was stunned, just shocked that this was something he was hearing. And for us as a family, it was very disheartening. You know, it took a blow to the hope that we had for this election. And hopefully it was just that one voter. I'm not so naive to believe that it was, but I absolutely do think, even within the party, race played in some people's votes. And I just want to share that, and I'll take your response off the air. Have a great day.
Thanks, Elizabeth. That's sad to hear. Not surprising, given that, you know, at the national level, we've seen how white nationalism is driving our national politics right now. You know, before we wrap this up, Stephanie Mickle, I think you wrote a book. Why don't you mention it?
Sure. Well, thank you so much. I have a new book out. It's called Follow the Leader, Believe in Yourself, Craft Your Future. And it's about why more women should get involved in the political process, and specifically very practical ways as to how women who may be inspired or enraged or what have you and feeling like they want to get involved, what specific things that they can do to start really evaluating whether or not they want to make that decision to run, or if they have already declared their candidacy, specific things that they can do to improve their chances. And we've definitely seen that a record number of women will serve in the Congress as a result of the elections this week. So I think that more and more women are starting to find their political voice.
Well, Katie Ross, Stephanie Mickle of Mickle Public Affairs, thanks so much for being on today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And still to come, 100 years ago, it was known as the War to End All Wars. That certainly didn't happen. Marking World War I around town this Veterans Day weekend, we'll tell you about that after this.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with the 16th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union branches, Two Men in a Truck, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
Learn how Europe changed America in World War I.
It was a great cultural awakening. Now, there was a song, How You Gonna Keep Him Down on the Farm Once He's Been to Paris?
Discover what Poland's cultural capital of Krakow can teach us.
We wanted to preserve the site for future generations to show, hey, this is how bad it can get.
And find the fun in the back roads of the Balkans on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday morning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, Veterans Day is this Sunday, and one of the most moving local observations will happen in Riverside at Memorial Park. It will be a commemoration of the more than 1,500 Floridians who died in the Great War, World War I. And what you might not have realized as you've walked through that beautiful riverfront park is that Memorial Park was designed and built 100 years ago for those veterans and those who died in the Great War. Here with more about this, Percy Rosenblum III. He's president of the Memorial Park Association. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Board Marketing Chair Michelle Luthen also with us. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Okay, so we'll talk about the event in a moment, but first, Percy, let's talk about this park because it truly is a treasure, one of the most beautiful public spaces in this city. Can you tell us a little more about the history of the park?
Sure. Immediately following, the day after Armistice, the Rotary Club of Jacksonville decided we needed a memorial for all those who gave all in the Great War. So they got together what's called the Citizens Committee, paired up with Nina Kummer and others in the city, and lo and behold, about 6 years later, Memorial Park was unveiled to the public on Christmas Day, 1924.
Wow.
Hundreds of people in the park there to see the unveiling of the great Charles Pillar sculpture, Spiritualized Life.
Which stands today.
Absolutely.
And it's such an icon. And the space has changed fairly little over the decades, right? I mean, the circular space, the waterfront balustrade, the statue. There have been some improvements, though, over the years.
The footprint of the park is exactly the same. And for the most part, it is pretty much the same. However, over the years, as you might imagine, things happen. And it was in 1986 that the Memorial Park Association was formed to make sure that the park was kept as the Olmsted brothers and Nina Kummer envisioned.
And what a gift that's been over the years. Of course, Hurricane Irma caused some damage to the waterfront break, but you're working on fixing that.
We're working on it. And we have a great, it is a city park, by the way, and we have a great private-public partnership with the City of Jacksonville and the Parks and Recreation Department. So we're all working together to get the balustrade back intact and put it all back together.
The city's actually started work on the bulkhead this week, so they're working on that now. And then the balustrade, their hope is that it will be all reconstructed by next summer.
So this Sunday, this Veterans Day, I'm pleased and honored to be helping to moderate the event you'll be having at Memorial Park, which was first conceived exactly 100 years ago after the Great War, World War I. A lot's going to be happening this weekend. Can you take us through the agenda? What all's on tap?
Sure. So on Saturday, November 10th, starting at 10 a.m., Dr. R.B. Rosenberg from Clayton State University will be speaking about his research of the list of Floridians who died in World War I. As some people may know, we unearthed the scrolls which were buried when the park was dedicated on Christmas Day, 1924. We unearthed the scrolls in late September. And so he's been using that list and comparing it to a list that he's already been researching. And so he's going to be talking about how he went about that process. The interesting thing is when the park was dedicated, it was dedicated to the 1,220 Floridians who died. His list is at now actually almost up to 1,600 Floridians who died in World War I. So he's going to be talking about that. As well as telling us some stories about these individuals. I think the association really wanted to be able to tell the stories of these men and women 100 years later. There's something really amazing about doing that. So he's helping us to do that. There are a lot of Jacksonville names on the list, Bosco, Stockton. So he's going to be telling those stories and bringing it to life.
It's been a century, and so we can't let this be lost to time. We have to keep the history alive, particularly in the minds of children that will be coming this weekend, including my own. And you're both wearing poppy pins this morning,
which is a
symbol of World War I. Can you talk about the Remembrance Poppy and what will be happening with the poppies this weekend?
I'll let Michelle handle that because she and Kelly Varn and Janelle Moraine have been working very hard on that.
Yeah. And just one more thing on the Saturday program at 10 a.m. The scrolls will actually be available for the public to view for the first time, fully restored by our paper conservator and Seibert. So that's another amazing thing that will be there. And that's going to be at the Garden Club. Regarding the poppies, we are so excited to have glass poppies that were blown, or handcrafted by the artist Brian Fuse at Jacksonville University. We've created 160 poppies, so one poppy for every 10 Floridian lives lost in World War I. They're actually going to be on display during the Jacksonville Youth Symphony's performance. And then afterwards, or actually during the program, people can come up and purchase a poppy. All of the funds raised will go back to the Memorial Park Association. And we were able to do this because of a generous donation by the Hicks family. So
very nice. And of course, the poppy, the symbol of the poppy, was inspired by a famous poem from the World War I era, In Flanders Fields, by the Canadian poet John McCrae. He died near the end of the war. Is that, that's correct, isn't it?
Yes. I'm not sure about that part, but we will have a reading. Caitlin
Lafier,
who did it for us on Memorial Day, or actually last Veterans Day, I believe. And she does a fantastic job, and she's a product of the local art school here.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. You know, it's so great to have you both here, because I can't tell you how many times I've been in Memorial Park with my kids or friends or just driven by it. And every time you're there, or even kind of go by and look out, you know, and see the statue and the river and just people playing with their dogs or just enjoying the beauty of that space, it's just so important that these spaces are maintained, because not only are they beautiful, they're really a tie to the city's past. And it's just great to have you both to kind of educate our listeners about this, because not everyone's aware of this history.
Well, thank you. And it is the mission of the Memorial Park Association to enhance, promote, and preserve Memorial Park. And we're very dedicated to that mission.
And obviously you need support. So when people come this weekend, this is basically a way to raise awareness, raise funds, raise friends, the whole thing.
The whole thing, exactly. And remember those who gave all in the Great War and other wars.
Yeah, and there are World War II memorials. There are plenty of war memorials all over Jacksonville, and there's a strong military and veteran community here. But this is this goes so far back into history that it's nice to see this being emphasized this weekend because it's just not as commonly remembered mm-hmm. on Veterans Day weekend, Michelle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important that we remember, and tell the stories as we come up on this anniversary.
Brian tweets the show, "My grandfather and his brother served in France in World War I. They both came back to Connecticut, but his brother died a few years later from the shrapnel still in him." People forget how bloody and hideous this war was and how troops were dug into trenches mm-hmm. In Europe. And when the veterans came back, they were seen as having suffered. They called it shell shock. They didn't have a diagnosis of PTSD then. It was just they said, well, this guy has shell shock. They didn't know what to do, how to treat these veterans.
Well, there was new weaponry that was brought to fore in this event. It was totally horrific. And that's why they called it the Great War and the War to End All Wars, because it was so terrible that they figured nobody would ever do this again. And yet here we are.
Right. That's the tragedy of it, that it literally was called that. Mm-hmm. And a few decades later, there was yet another world war. And so it's important to know our history. So I would encourage everyone to come on out Sunday to Memorial Park in Riverside for this important commemoration. It's really going to be quite beautiful, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. People need to show up around 5 o'clock, right?
It's going to start at 5, so we're encouraging people to come early. So come 3:30, 4 o'clock, stake out your spot, bring your picnic blanket or your folding up chairs. There will be food trucks as well as the evening after the Jacksonville Youth Symphony performs. There will be fireworks, again, looking to celebrate this 100-year anniversary like we haven't seen before in Memorial Park. So.
Excellent. Well, Percy Rosenblum III is president of Memorial Park Association, also on the board. Michelle Luthen, both in studio this morning. Again, that's Sunday in Memorial Park for Veterans Day. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And more about Veterans Day observances coming up after the break. Keep listening.
Down on the farm after they see you, Harry. How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, jabbing around and painting the town? How you gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. Imagine Reuben when he meets his pa. He'll kiss his cheek and holler, ooh la la. How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Terry? Tell me, mother, how you're gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Terry? And how you're gonna keep them away from rectors jazzing around and painting the town? Woo! How you're gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. They'll never want to see a rake or plow. And who the heck can parley boo a cow? How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Terry?
Do you have a story to tell? Since 2003, StoryCorps has been collecting and archiving stories from all over the country. From November 18th to December 21st, StoryCorps will be right here in Jacksonville. StoryCorps is the 2-time Peabody Award-winning nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories. If you've ever listened to their NPR program, you know how powerful and touching these stories can be. To have StoryCorps record your story, make your reservation today at wjct.org/events.
I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump takes his place alongside the leaders of China, Russia, and Turkey, who accept no dissenting voices in their inner circles. Next time on The World, how strong men lead and how their countries fare under authoritarian rule. That story plus more impact from the midterm elections. Today's news with a great big picture window. It's on the world this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
All right, here's some economic irony. In the place where the Industrial Revolution was born, some of the locals aren't all that wild about fracking.
The business community actually wants it. What they don't want are protesters outside of their premises.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Energy earthquakes, and every time there is a protest, fracking in the UK. Next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
It's been 40 years since cult leader Jim Jones told his followers to drink poison. 900 Americans died, and a young congressional aide named Jackie Speer was shot trying to help victims escape. Today, she helps represent the city shaken by these murders. Congresswoman Jackie Speer on Surviving Jonestown. Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back, and we continue our trip back in time to 100 years ago, when the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918 marked the end of World War I, called the War to End All Wars. Of course, this conflict devastated Europe and scarred the entire world. As we were talking about in the previous segment, technological advances made this war particularly horrific, with mass casualties. Many people were moved to write poetry about the war, so much so that World War I poetry is a genre all its own. Canadian writer and performer and now Jacksonville resident Jeff Bradley has long been moved by this poetry, and so to commemorate Veterans Day and the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, Jeff has created a work for theater that features this powerful poetry and other writings from soldiers and loved ones touched by World War I. He joins us now in studio. Jeff Bradley, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me here.
Good to see you. And you've brought together a group of the finest actors in town to recreate your vision on stage.
Yes, we've got actors and a few musicians. It's going to be a real theater piece. It's not just a reading of poetry.
What drew you to this subject matter?
Well, my grandfather fought in World War I, and I have a degree in English literature, and part of that was studying that genre of poetry. I was really moved by it. These are poets that wrote while they were in the trenches, some of these guys. So It's really powerful poetry, and it's always been in the back of my mind. Starting in 1914, when it was the beginning of the war, I never had a chance to do it till I settled down in Jacksonville and I met up with these group of people.
And now you're putting this together.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Younger people might not realize the origin of the phrase, oh, we were really in the trenches. I was in the trenches with her on that project, or whatever people might say. That stems from World War I, when the opposing sides literally dug trenches and then lobbed bombs at each other.
It was just a horrific battle. And it was a war like the world had not seen before. The weapons were, the first time tanks were used, aerial combat, chemical weapons. And these people, these soldiers, were sometimes as close as 30 yards apart, dug in for years in front of you there. And basically, we're just trying to kill more of theirs than ours. It was just a landlocked stalemate.
Right. Just absolutely hideous. And so many Americans lost, so many lost in Europe. And so you are presenting dramatized writings from the trenches of the War to End All Wars. This is Sunday, 4 o'clock at Babs Lab, Cork Art District, the great Barbara Colicello's Babs Lab, which is a great place to go. This is over in the Cork District at King and Roselle Streets. This is free, although donations are accepted, and you're going to donate the proceeds to Five Star Veterans Center. They help homeless vets. And you have some poetry, I think, that you'd like to read here.
Well, in compliment to your previous guest, I thought maybe I could do Flanders Field for you. It's written by was born very close to where John McRae was born in Canada.
Okay, here it is, in Flanders Fields.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place. And in the sky, the lark still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amidst the guns below. We are the dead, Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Thank you for that. There's a reason that poem has resonated for 100 years.
Yes.
The poppy. And that was a wonderful interpretation. And that's just a sample of what you're going to be doing on Sunday.
And as I said, we have music. And I like to say it's dramatized. It's not acted out. It's not, but it will be moving.
It will. What a wonderful way to spend Veterans Day. I really encourage everyone to check this out. It's The War to End All Wars, dramatized writings from the trenches of that war, which ended 100 years ago this year. It's just amazing that it's been a century as we look back. So go on over to the Cork Arts District and to Babs Lab for this free event. Donations are encouraged and they will help homeless veterans. So Jeff Bradley, great to see you. Thanks for putting this together.
Thanks again, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening this morning and to all of our guests and callers. Michelle Corum is our director. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is 89.9. Always glad to have you listening, and we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.